got some broccoli. Just
I'll always let you know about your broccoli mouth.
You are very good at coming up with songs on the fly, Jordan.
I'll sing you a song, and the experience will go south.
Well, that could be taken two different ways.
Well, when you're talking about broccoli in your teeth, I'm not sure if you're really meaning broccoli.
There are a lot of interesting fetishes out there.
Or something else.
Broadband internet service providers in Real Simple Syndication are proud to bring you
Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night. That over there is Carlin.
And that is Jordan. And Jordan, you made that dramatic.
I did.
Stretched it out.
I'm excited
because Devil in the House. Hey.
Where? Is it like MC Chris? Like, I'm a devil in your house.
No, nothing like that. Actually, it's because we're doing one of my picks, and my pick is a movie called The House of the Devil.
Now, I'm kind of sad, Carlin, because this is only 1 year shy of being a 2010 release.
I knew you were going to bring that up. I knew you were going to bring up the 2010, because when I wrote it down, I'm like, 2009, I was like, it's 1 year off. I know Jordan has got to say something.
1 year off. What are you doing with that, man? Come on.
Hey, 2009 had something decent
going on. Well, I know. I mean, I think 2009 was actually a fairly good year for movies overall. And, you know, it gave us the debut movie that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
This is the debut movie for both the writer slash director slash editor of the film, and also one of the big stars. This was one of her first movies as well. If not, I think it was her second movie, but her first big
like
performance.
Starring role.
Yeah, her.
Got it.
So this movie, as you said, is called House of the Devil.
The House of the Devil, and it kind of doesn't pull any punches with the name of it. It's pretty straightforward intentionally.
Right, yes, because there is truth in advertising every once in a while.
Yeah.
But this film was created pretty much in every aspect by Ty West.
Yes.
And Ty West, this was like his, was this his first film?
I don't think it was his first film, but I think this was his first successful feature-length film.
Okay.
I think he had done, I don't know if he had any feature-lengths before this, but I know he had done, like, some shorts. But this was the first one that, like, really put him on the map as far as films go. But then he wrote and directed this, and he also, I believe, edited it.
Yeah, he did.
He wrote it a lot.
Directed it, edited it. I'm surprised he didn't actually do the score as well, but that was actually done by someone else.
But he was the writer-director for this one. But he's also done a few other ones that have gotten some attention. He did The Innkeepers. That got a lot of good acclaim. I saw that film, and the pacing style and the kind of, like, tension building is very similar with The Innkeepers. Also, his most recent film that came out real recently, within the past few months, I think, actually, The Sacrament.
Yeah, that one.
I watched it, like, a few weeks ago, honestly. Not remembering that it was a Ty West film,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of the same kind of elements of story pacing, but that one's really interesting because it's roughly based off the Jonestown Massacre.
Interesting.
So, yeah, just, you know, Jim Jones and his cult following and all that kind of stuff. So it's a pretty crazy look at kind of cult mentality and some people who get stuck in the middle of a cult when things go sour.
Yeah, so. Go south. And then another film that he did was Trigger Man. You know, so he's done quite a few films. Wasn't he involved in the VHS project as well?
Yes.
And the ABCs of Death, too?
Not sure if he did ABCs of Death, but I wouldn't be surprised, because he had done a lot of stuff. He was also had a small part acting in the also kind of recent film that came out within the past year called You're Next, which was done by Adam Wingard, who's a friend of his. I think Ty West is, like, the third person who gets killed in that film.
Nice.
And the first two people who get killed within, like, the first 5 minutes. So he gets killed pretty early on.
I'm pretty interested in one of his next projects, one of the projects he's working on for right now. It's called A Valley of Vengeance, mm-hmm. and it's supposed to be a Western.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, And
you have my attention.
Yeah, yeah. I love the Western, and I love mixing Westerns with horror. I also love mixing Westerns with science fiction, but
just Western anything.
Yeah, if you throw the Wild West into it, and it's got like some kind of horrific aspect to it, I'm pretty much there. I'm sold on that. But let's go ahead and now that we've talked about Mr. West some, let's go ahead and give the Netflix summary.
Sounds good.
So, a cash-strapped college student takes a babysitting job during a full lunar eclipse and discovers her employers are hiding a sick and twisted secret.
Ooh.
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 What kind of sick and
they
twisted?
They give away too much. Once again.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
Once again, another film that I wish people would just see without knowing anything about it. I mean, it says The House of the Devil. It's pretty on
yeah.
the nose, kind of, but I don't know. Just don't read the.
I kind of thought you meant that the girls' employers were giving away too much, like candy or something.
Oh no! Well, they did have a bowl of candy just sitting out. I assume it was candy. Couldn't really see.
Yeah, yeah. One of the characters was going to town on it too.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So pretty much everything about this Netflix summary gives everything away.
Yeah.
About the movie. I mean, it's actually kind of surprising how much they can give away in just a short sentence.
Well, we talked about the whole trailer, you know, trailers for films issue, where the trailers give away, like, so much. You see, I mean, you know the entire film before you see it, so.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, but that's not new. We've talked about that before, so.
Yeah. Now, this film, the main star of the movie was Jocelyn Donahue, and she was playing the character named Samantha. She went by Sam for most of the movie whenever people were talking to her. And she stayed in the horror genre for her film repertoire, I guess you could say. Like, she's been in Insidious Chapter 2, which, did you see that?
I saw the first one. I haven't seen the second one. A lot of people were all about Insidious.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to love it because James Wan did it, and James Wan did the Saw films, and I think he did a good job with that. I wasn't big about Insidious. There were some good aspects to it, but it was corny to me in the end.
Yeah.
Especially when they reveal, like, the most demonic character who's supposed to be kind of like the devil. Like, he looked so corny, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
I will watch the second one. I haven't yet, but I don't expect to really like it that much.
Right. Another film that she's done, I think it was actually her first role, and then this was her big breakout role right after it, was The Burrowers.
I've seen that, and I was pretty underwhelmed with that, too.
Yeah.
It has a great concept, once again. It's just once the bad guys show up,
it just falls apart.
Yeah, because they're not all that great, and I don't know. You might like it, though, because it's kind of Western-ish.
Okay.
It has a Western aspect to it. So there's your, you know, what you're looking for, like horror and Western.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Watch that and let me know what you think about it.
We'll see. We'll have to see
how it wasn't terrible. Like, I had higher hopes for it. Put it that way.
I mean, I think one of the things about low budget horror is you gotta set your expectations at a certain level.
Yes. Like zero.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're
just surprised.
If your expectations were like a 5%, I'm sorry if you were underwhelmed. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you.
But another film that she was in, and this one caught my eye. I haven't seen it, but it looked interesting. It's called The Last Godfather. It's apparently a Korean movie that she starred in, where she was playing, like, it was about a Korean mobster who was training his son, who was mentally disabled, to be the next godfather.
Huh.
Yeah, and she is that mentally disabled son's love interest.
That sounds like a very interesting yet convoluted concept.
Yeah. And it doesn't get a lot of very good reviews.
Okay,
but it's
just too convoluted.
It's probably a little too convoluted, and it's played up as a bit of a mobster comedy, which, since when have you ever heard of a mobster comedy?
I mean, I have. There was one with, like, Jay Moore in it that was supposed to be, like a scary movie style where they made fun of a bunch of different horror films, but it's like they made fun of a bunch of mobster films.
Mm.
I forget what it was called, but it looked really dumb. I heard it wasn't that good. So
yeah, and her the Netflix mentions two big villains in this. The Mr. and Mrs. Ullman. And Mr. Ullman is played by Tom Noonan. And he was fantastic in this movie.
He was more than fantastic.
Yeah, he actually blew me away with how well he did that character.
I wanted more of him on screen.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. Like, I felt... The first time this is the second time I watched the film. The first time I watched it was, I think, maybe 2 years ago. 1 or 2 years ago. 2 years, I believe. When I watched it, I remember being very taken with how amazing he was at being the villain in this film.
Yeah.
And it was just, like, the perfect, like, creepy, but also, like, nice.
It seemed like the character, you know, aside from being, not to give too much away, because this is called The House of the Devil, but aside from the fact that he was a Satanist,
right,
who was willing to sacrifice young women, he seemed like a pretty nice guy.
Yeah, he's very polite. He's just like, look, I'm just the messenger.
Yeah.
He says that at one point, I'm just doing what I'm supposed to, what I'm told.
So he at the end of the movie, he says, you can kill me if you want. I'm just telling you what's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so...
He was pretty matter-of-fact about that.
Yeah, his character was pretty cool, and...
He's like, look, I gotta put a demon baby in you.
Yeah,
no big deal. Just go with it. It'll be over soon.
It'll be over quickly. I mean, you don't even have to raise the kid. We'll just... You know,
and there's no intercourse either, so...
Yeah, I mean, which is pretty remarkable, considering, you know, what they wanted her to do. But Mrs. Ullman was played, and I found this person to be really interesting. She was played by Mary Warrenoff. And
done a lot of horror stuff.
A lot of horror stuff. She's also done a lot of TV work. Oh, I didn't mention what some of other Tom Noonan's other
works. Sorry.
Yeah.
We got so like high on his performance that we forgot to mention other stuff.
And we'll talk more about his performance in a minute, I'm sure. But he was in Eight-Legged Freaks, which...
haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it either. But the next two I have seen. The first one is Seraphim Falls.
Haven't seen it.
Which is... It's a weird kind of... It's a bizarro quasi-mystical western that stars Pierce Brosnan and Liam Neeson.
Okay.
And it doesn't work at all.
Okay.
It's a pretty sad movie. It has a great cast, and, you know, it has some elements that would be really cool, but it falls apart.
So it sounds like Deadfall.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyone who hasn't listened to that episode, seriously, go back and listen to Deadfall. You can probably even listen to it if you haven't watched the film, but it does help to watch it first.
Yeah. And then also, another one that Tom Noonan was in was the TV series Damages, where he plays one of the investigators there. And if you like legal dramas, or if you like Glenn Close or Rose Byrne, Damages is a really good show.
I can pass on it then.
You know,
I would check it out just to see how Tom Noonan does, because after seeing him in The House of the Devil, I'm very excited about that.
So moving on to Mary Warrenoff as Mrs. Ullman. Did you know, actually, and I found this pretty interesting, that Mary Warrenoff was actually one of, what's his name? The guy with the soup cans. He was a painter, artist.
What's his nuts? I can't remember either. Why can't I remember? Very influential.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's the guy who did the basically developed pop art.
Oh, that's bad that neither of us can remember
moment. No, this is really embarrassing. But... You know, he had the...
Everyone knows who we're talking
about. Yeah, the hayloft in... Or the loft, the factory in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he had a crew called the Superstars.
Mm-hmm.
And she was one of the superstars.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so...
I didn't know about that.
Oh, my gosh. Why are we blanking on this?
It's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's really bad.
There was a movie about him, too, and it had Hayden Christensen in it.
Yeah.
He's terrible.
Well, I think he's good with the right amount of direction. But he's like
pass.
Anyway, but Mary Warrenoff was one of his entourage, and then he started using her in the artwork that he was doing, and he was mixing film with pop art and everything to make his own stuff. And it was at a point where he was using her as an actress in short films and everything like that. So that's how she really got her start. And then she started moving into television work, movie work, everything like that. So she's had a really long career. One of the movies that she's done that's pretty popular from the 80s is called Eating Raoul, which is apparently about, like...
Andy Warhol. God damn it. Well, I couldn't remember. Andy Warhol. Everyone knows that name.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's embarrassing.
Oh, well.
Sorry.
Just forget that we had that issue.
I guess we have to turn in our nerd cards if we can't remember Andy Warhol.
Nah, I don't think so. Because that's an art thing. I mean, if you pride yourself on that, then yes, but I don't, so...
Comic book guy here, so...
Okay, well then yes, yours is revoked. Well, mine is still in effect.
Well, thank you for listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night. It's now going to be just Carlin's Most Excellent Movie Night.
And the House of the Devil, anyway.
Yeah, but anyway, Mary Warrenoff, she's been in a lot of films. Like I was saying, one of her most popular films was from the 80s. It was about... a prudish couple who wanted to get rid of swingers and was called of Eating Raoul. And then she's also appeared on a bunch of TV shows, one of which is a show that I really like called Babylon 5.
Okay. Never seen it, sorry.
No, that's fine. It's it's kind of like... it's basically the idea of Star Trek Deep Space Nine released about a year before Star Trek
Deep Space Nine. I hated Star Trek. I'm sorry. That's another... God, I just hated Star Trek. Part of it was because my dad made me watch the old stuff when I was young, and it just, like, you know, when you're a kid, like, you're like, this is stupid and hokey, and it's just nothing going on.
I don't know. I mean, when I was a kid, that was when Star Trek The Next Generation was on full first run syndication.
Shout out Will Wheaton. What?
Yeah. But, I mean, I was entranced by Star Trek The Next Generation. No. Now I go back and I try and watch it, and I'm like, geez, this looks like it was lighted for the Hallmark Channel.
Yeah, what did I see in it?
Yeah, but anyway, another film that she has done is Attack of the 50-Foot Cheerleader. So
I would like to check that out. Sounds ridiculously stupid.
Yes, and so she's got a long and diverse career in cinema.
I watch terrible movies, just so people know. I do, from time to time, just to see them.
Just to see how bad they actually are.
Shout out to a really awful movie I watched recently, Hansel and Gretel, Witch Hunters, with Jeremy Renner. I do not know how they must have thrown so much money at him.
They
for
must
that
have.
Role. It was terrible.
That I know that terrible. That came out right when he was getting big as Hawkeye and everything as well. So anyway, that's who I have written down. Another person who was in the movie was Greta Gerwig, who playing Megan, which is Sam's close friend. And I think she's also... She's gone on to do a lot of very popular stuff. I think she was in the indie breakthrough film He Sang. And then she's currently working in development for a spinoff of How I Met Your Mother.
Okay.
So
also
she's
something I've not watched.
I haven't really watched that either, but I do
know... Here's good.
It's something that the kids talk about.
Yeah. Those kids these days.
Those kids.
They talk about that. In my opinion, not talking about her acting, but my favorite thing that happened with her in this film and her character Megan is when she got her face blown off.
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of an abrupt little thing that happened.
Well, the thing is, it lets you know that shit just got real.
Yeah.
Like, this is serious.
Well,
right
Victor
here.
Walks up and this character named Victor... walks up and goes, "Are you the babysitter?" And she's like, "No, I just dropped her off." And so he's like, "Okay," and blows her brains out right in the car.
It's like, oh, well, then I can kill you because you're not the important person.
Apparently he likes killing people.
But that's a good transition because I actually want to talk about the person who plays Victor in this.
Okay.
It's not a huge role, but this guy is A.J. Bowen is his name. And he gets a lot of roles in horror films, specifically horror films that rotates around, like, Ty West and his buddies. He's in a lot of their stuff. So it was really interesting because I remembered when I was watching this film that I've seen him before, and I'm like, man, I've seen him in a bunch of stuff recently and within the past years that I watch. And it's not because I was seeking him out or I was seeking out films that Adam Wingard and Ty West and all those people did.
Right.
But it just kept happening. I'm like, I keep seeing this guy. So I looked into him, like, who is he? So his name's AJ Bowen, and he runs with that the whole Mumblecore crew, which will up. Whoa! I just flung my pen. Well, it was impressive though.
It was.
We'll talk about the Mumblecore thing in a little bit. But he has been in that I've seen these films: The Sacrament, Rites of Spring, You're Next, A Horrible Way to Die, Hatchet 2, and The Signal.
So he's pretty busy.
Yes. Which of all those films, I'd say the best one is The Signal. The Signal is like a kind of zombie film. But it's, I mean, it's not really zombie. It's like something that goes over the airwaves that makes people rage out, basically, mm-hmm. and start killing each other. It's a really well done film, honestly. The second best one out of all those would be You're Next. That one is, it was overhyped, but still a good film.
Yeah. The thing about him was that it seemed like his face was really familiar. And I don't know why. It might have been, you said Pontypool, right?
No, I didn't.
No.
You were thinking Pontypool because I said The Signal and I described a little bit of that because kind of similar.
Yeah, but I mean, he's got a face that looks very much
recognizable.
Someone you would see every day.
Right.
And I think that's actually a really good trait for someone to have as, you know, someone who appears in a lot of horror movies, because if you look like the guy next door, well, then you make a great character for like a serial killer or a Satanist or, you know, whatever it is that you want to have look innocent, but then actually turn out to be someone who's a little more devious or insidious.
Well, let us talk about Mumblecore then, because it's important to do with this film, because this is one of the entries in the kind of Mumblecore genre. Mumblecore basically started with a core group of friends, and they didn't know each other since they were kids. They were all originally from like the Atlanta, Georgia area, and then they ended up meeting in Los Angeles.
Right.
And AJ Bone was one of those people. So mm-hmm. this Mumblecore crew is comprised of Ty West, Adam Wingard, AJ Bowen, Simon Barrett, Roxanne Benjamin, E.L. Katz, and Jacob Gentry. So they all make film together, and they, you know, will be in each other's things, and will help, you know, work with each other. But when you're talking about Mumblecore is basically gory horror films that try to have very realistic dialogue in them.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the times they'll actually just kind of let the characters, like, riff. Or the actors, I mean. They'll let the actors riff when they're in character and just kind of like talk because they want it to be very natural.
Now,
which I like. And that's why you end up getting some of the mumbling, because people do that in real life.
Right.
And that's why it's mumblecore. So
now, one question that I have for you is that there's two separate terms here. There's mumblecore, C-O-R-E,
mm-hmm.
and then there's mumblegore.
Right.
Which is G-O-R-E.
Mm-hmm.
Are we differentiating between the two, or are we saying that they're similar here?
When I was I know that the mumblecore came along and was tied in with the mumblegore because mumblecore originated with all those horror films.
Right.
So I think it was mumblecore happened, and then people spun mumblegore off of that.
Right.
And we're kind of like, okay, well, they're going to go off and do other films, so it'll still be mumblecore, but all these horror films will be dubbed the mumblegore ones.
Right, okay. Because, I mean, there have been aspects of mumblecore films that's going as far back as 1978 with Girlfriends.
Okay.
So, you know, it's something that, you know, where it's a lo-fi aspect, low budget and everything like that. A lot of people would say that Woody Allen's Manhattan is also a predecessor mm-hmm. of the genre as well.
Had it really been used, that terminology really been
no,
used prior?
No, really, the term
I think it was just kind of coined when these guys came along.
Yeah, it was more termed, like, it was more, like, coined in 2005 around South by Southwest by a guy named Eric Masunaga, I think is how you pronounce his name. It's, you know, and he was just, like, noticing some similarities between some films like Mutual Appreciation, The Puffy Chair, Kissing on the Mouth, that kind of thing.
Okay.
You know, so it really came into focus, though, when Bujalski used it in an interview with IndieWire. So that's some stuff there about it as well.
Yeah. Well, getting to the actual film itself.
Yeah.
Ty West, what he really set out to do with this film is make it a full-on homage to 1970s and 1980s horror films.
Yes.
And he was trying to do that by not just portraying the genre, but also using a lot of the same techniques in filmmaking and editing and all that that were used then.
Right.
And in my opinion, he did a very good job making it look and feel like it was a 80s horror film of that time. And I mean, like, he, you know, he had the Walkman in there. He intentionally chose locations that did not look modernized. And I thought, and this was one of the things I wrote down, I was like, very smart to use a college campus for a yes. lot of it, because a lot of buildings on college campuses are really old.
Yes.
So it's pretty much timeless. You could use it for any decade. Well,
pretty
you
much
want.
Any time that you would want, you've got this college campus that would work for you.
Yeah. And I thought that was just a smart idea.
It was. And it also was a good idea because college campuses have a very cold and industrial feel to them a lot of times.
True. Yeah.
Like a lot
very
of
impersonal.
Yeah. And like a lot of the hallways that Sam was walking through throughout the film
looks so drab.
Were very drab and everything like that. But it was also like a good contrast to the house in and of itself, because you've got all of this dark hallways and she spends a lot of time walking around campus, because basically what happens is Mr. Ullman stands her up,
right?
You know, because he's supposed to meet her, and then something happens, which probably means somebody is getting cut up.
Someone's dead.
Yeah, and he's not able to make it when he says he will. And so then she wanders around the campus for a while, and you see how sterile this environment is that she's living in.
Yeah.
You know, and she does. She's very discontent with her college life, it appears. She's very...
Well, I mean, you see that she can't get into her own room because there's a sock on the door because her roommate's having sex. And that's pretty much... By doing that so early on in the film, they're signaling to you that the roommate is very inconsiderate. That she...
Yeah.
That they don't get along, this person doesn't really care about Sam's feelings and needs and all that, so it lets you know that she's not feeling at home
yeah.
where she is.
Well, and also, like, the film opens up with her going to get an apartment off campus.
Right.
You know, and that
she wants to get away,
yeah.
obviously.
Well, that to me, it took me a long time through the movie to figure that out, because the script didn't really explicitly imply what was going on. You were left to infer that she was unhappy with her living situation because, you know, she was locked out of her room for a while, and then she, like, goes into the bathroom and turns on the water so she can be alone.
Okay, which is something that... It's a small thing, but it kind of bothered me a little bit, because I remember watching that, and I'm like, okay, she's turning the water on, and then she's sitting down crying, and I'm like, oh, okay, she turned it on so people can't hear her crying.
Right.
But it's a bathroom for numerous people at once.
Right.
And she's sitting in one of the stalls with the door open. So if somebody comes in,
they'll just, like, see all the water running.
Well, they'll see the water running, but they'll probably hear her at that point.
Anyway.
Or at least see what she's doing, because she hasn't closed the door. So, I don't know, it kind of didn't seem like it jived for me with, oh, I'm going to, you know, cover up the fact that I'm crying, but I'm not going to close the friggin' door
right.
to the stall.
Yeah, that
know?
Doesn't make a lot of sense. But also, she's talking with her friend Megan about how, you know, this situation doesn't seem to go, isn't going in her favor at all.
Yeah.
You know, and...
While
eating terrible pizza, yes. And drinking, I loved the Coke cups.
The old style logo
and everything. It's like, I wonder where they found those for that.
You know, I found myself wondering that too. I was like, how hard was that to find?
Yeah.
It might not have been all that hard. They actually may have been able to contact the Coca-Cola company and say, hey, you know, we want like an old logo. And
yeah.
I'm sure they have had it somewhere.
Well, I'm wondering, I'm sure that they keep the logos.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
forever, but I'm wondering if they like if maybe someone they knew had a stack of them somewhere from when they worked at a pizza place and it closed down. But possible it, too. They did a great job of like showing how lonely her life is, you know, and she doesn't interact with anybody on campus except for Megan and the girl who is really inconsiderate, you know. So she wants to get out of the situation and she wants to go into something that's better. And she has this horrible thing where she doesn't have enough money to pay the deposit, but her landlord's going to let her slide a little bit.
Right. Who the landlord's played by Dee Wallace. Love Dee Wallace. She's been in so much stuff. I actually met her at a horror convention, and I have a glossy signed of her from the movie The Howling, which is like a picture of her growing the werewolf fangs. It was a great moment in the movie. I'm going to be honest, that's, in my opinion, like the best werewolf film ever made.
You have mentioned that a few times.
The Howling is awesome. It's great. Everyone, if you haven't seen it, go check it out. But if anyone doesn't recognize Dee Wallace from The Howling, she was the mother in E.T. She was also the mother in the movie Cujo. So she's been in a lot of big-time things.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's good to see her still getting work and everything that.
She was in Rob Zombie's recent horror film, Lords of Salem.
Okay.
Which, as far as a Rob Zombie film went, it wasn't bad. I've hated a lot of his stuff, but Lords of Salem was pretty decent.
So, she goes and she sees something that gives her a chance to at least start making the money. Because it doesn't seem like she really has a job.
No, and I guess a lot of people are probably supposed to assume that, too, based on the fact that she's a college student.
Right. Right, right. So she finds this babysitting opportunity.
On the most suspicious-looking sign that just says, what is it? It's just like, babysitter needed, and it has dollar signs, and it's just purely white other than that.
I mean, it's, I at first I was thinking, well, what do you mean by suspicious? But I guess you could see that. I mean, when you wander around a college campus, you see signs like that all the time.
That's true. But I mean in the context of the film, like knowing that it's a horror film, you're like, that was suspicious.
If you think of it as a horror film, then that could be a little suspicious. But I mean, from my own experience, I don't think I ever did that in college, maybe for a study group or two, but I never really, you know, checked those out too closely.
Yeah.
But I thought it was cool. Like, she calls the number and there's the answering machine, and then the guy immediately calls that number back.
Which is actually a shot I really like too, camera work they did, because she talked on the, she left the message on the,
answering machine.
Yeah, through the payphone, and the shot is on of her on the payphone, and then she walks away, and it stays.
Yeah.
So you see her walking away in the background, and then it rings, and then she comes back, and it just looks, it looked really good to me, and it made it creepier in my opinion.
I think the film did a lot of good things with open shots like that, shots where it just let stuff happen, because a lot of her, like a lot of the opening credits is her walking from the apartment back to the college, and a lot of it is one long shot, like at the very first beginning it's a shot that lasts like 30 or 40 seconds and then they just kind of freeze frame while they put up the credits, so that was pretty interesting to see. Film work like that. And then also when she's like going through the house, like the different rooms, there's a lot of like film work that's done there. Another thing that they did interesting film wise, like with the camera work, was instead of using dollies to move in and out, they actually used the zoom.
Right. And that leads me to, I had made a list of kind of a lot of the things that they intentionally did to make it look like more of like an 80s horror film, because it was stuff that was actually being done at that time. They actually used 16mm film.
Yeah.
And you can tell, it looks
that
way.
It looked good, yeah.
It looked authentic. The camera zooms you were talking about, they would do a lot of those camera zooms onto characters.
Yeah.
They did that. The yellow font on, like, opening and closing credits.
Yeah.
The freeze frame on the final scene where Sam's laying in the hospital bed, and then it freeze frame on her just laying there, and then the yellow credits come up and everything.
Yeah.
Very 80s horror film-esque. So those were all that I wrote down, but I thought it was great that Ty West just took that time to be like, okay, what were the things that they did then, and how can I use these myself effectively within the confines of the story I want to tell. But to go a little bit further, he also wanted to make a mixture of a genre horror film. He wanted to take, he took the slasher, he took the haunted house, and he took what they call satanic panic film, and put that all together. And honestly, when you know that, when you hear all those components, and then you think about the entire storyline and how it played out, you can pinpoint all of those elements.
So what was the most slasherific moment of the film?
The end.
The end?
The end where she's trying to get away.
Oh.
That was very slasher-esque. But also just like the tension and pacing of her, you know, going around, you know, she's... You know, you get the guy, Victor, who comes to the door eventually and, delivers the pizza, that nasty-ass pizza.
Yeah.
Which I'm just, in my mind, figured it was the exact same pizza she was eating in the beginning of the film.
Yeah, it looks college pizza.
Yeah.
You know, and either college pizza can be really good or it can be awful.
Yeah. But then him just kind of, like, lighting up a cigarette and, like, looking around the house and stuff and just looking menacing, like, you know it's coming.
Yeah.
But the most slasher aspect, I do believe, was when she escaped from being tied up, that moment where she's running around and there was some actual slashing going on.
Yeah. Yeah, she's actually doing the one doing the slashing.
Yes, exactly. So she's fighting back, you know, and that's the final girl thing is going on there, which is in a lot of slasher films.
And also a bit of the virgin.
Yes.
Because you have it differentiated that her roommate is the one who's a slut who will sleep around.
Right.
But Sam is the one who's going to make sure that she stays on the straight and narrow and gets through school and everything like that.
And I think it's also kind of insinuated that she is a virgin because you have Mrs. Allman at one point who's really pushing her hard when she meets her about, oh, I bet all the boys really like you. I bet, you know, like making her uncomfortable about it. Like she's trying to feel out, is she a slut or is she a virgin?
Right, because apparently being a virgin is very important to...
Yes, because then you also see in one of the rooms in that house there are a bunch of dead bodies.
Yes.
Which can be taken as there are people who live there, but it could also be taken as these were people who they had come to the house and they figured out, ah, they're not virgins, kill them. So it could be either that wasn't explained, but they do say at one point, I think it's Mr. Allman says to Sam, you were chosen.
Yes.
So they had to find the right person.
The right
person. And that's why, you know, you were saying that he stood her up and he was like, oh, you know, things came up and all that. And you were alluding to they were probably killing people and stuff.
Yeah. Well,
it's probably because they had other people respond and they needed to figure out, is this person, quote, chosen?
Right.
No, they're not. Got to dispatch them. So let's move to the next one.
Well, and also the thing about it was that was really cool was that he says, well, there was another girl who came by, but she didn't work out. You know?
Yeah.
And he says it very kind of offhandedly and like he's being distracted. So that, I thought, was a really cool moment in the film as well.
Yeah, because, and this speaks to Tom Noonan's acting. You can see in his face, through his acting, that he's, as the character, remembering murdering this person, basically.
Yeah.
You know, like, he is distracted by his memories of, yeah, we had to murder that one, but also trying to not be suspicious.
Right.
But, let's be honest, so many things in this film are overtly suspicious, but that's kind of how these 80s horror films were, and 70s horror films.
Right.
They were... To the viewer, don't go in there, you idiot, or this person is clearly telling you they want to kill you, but you're not listening. There was a lot of that in there.
Yeah. Oh, and one thing I wanted to talk to you about was this idea that, and this was pretty prevalent in slasher movies of the 70s and 80s, that, you know, the babysitting scenario. You know, like, you have the idea that you're going to a house to watch, you know, small children, and then all of this horrific stuff happens to you.
You know? Adventures in Babysitting, anyone?
Exactly.
If you haven't listened to that podcast, go ahead and listen to that one.
Yeah, go ahead and listen to that one, because it's full of all sorts of horrific experiences No, not really. Actually, Adventures in Babysitting is a pretty fun movie. But, you know, to me, it was just pretty amazing to think, you know, that Sam is someone who's college educated and everything like that. But really the only experience that she, or the only job that she can really fall back on, even though she has an education, is childcare.
Right, because it's something that pretty much anyone can do.
Right.
It is the assumption. At least for that time period, I think that babysitters were synonymous with high school and college students.
Right.
I mean, really. So it fits the time frame and what was in films at that point.
Right.
I did want to point out about the babysitting thing. Yeah. There's a great, funny, foreshadowing quote from Megan's character when they were eating pizza and talking about this babysitting job, where Megan said, "It could be awful. You know, the kid could be from hell."
Yeah.
Ha ha! Because they're Satanists.
Exactly.
That's something that I don't think I picked up on the first time I watched it, but I definitely did the second time.
Yeah. You know, talking about the elements of it that were slasherific or slasher-esque, it did remind me in some parts of Psycho, you know, which is probably one of the most classic slasher movies of all time.
Right.
You know, because you have all of this talk about this mother character who's not seen for most of the movie, and then you also have like this big old house that the characters explore, and then there's you know, troubling things about that. Now, obviously, mother in Psycho is not the same type of character as the mother in The House of the Devil, but it was an interesting parallel. You know, have you seen Psycho?
No, sorry. Wow. There are a lot of like quintessential horror films I have not seen that everyone says I have to, and I'm trying to work to correct that. Haven't seen Psycho. I haven't seen Rosemary's Baby. I haven't seen The Exorcist. There are a lot. So
yeah, I've seen both Psycho and The Exorcist, but I haven't seen Rosemary's Baby. But anyway, one of the things about Psycho is that there's this mother character who goes and kills Marion Crane, the girl in the main part of the movie. I think her last name is Crane. I can't remember it correctly. But it happens in a shower. So then there's this scene in the shower where, you know, you can tell that things are getting more horrific for Sam's character, because she goes into this bathroom and there's, in the shower, there's these lumps of hair that's just magically appeared there. So I thought it was good that they used that parallelism, you know, to try and get the idea of what's going on with the slasher movie, you know, tying it into a motif that's easily understood.
Well, and it's interesting you bring up Psycho, because that was a Hitchcock film.
It was.
And I had written down, when I was doing my research on The House of the Devil, Roger Ebert, when he did a review of The House of the Devil,
he said it was very much like a Hitchcock
film. Yes, he said the tension building was so Hitchcockian, and that it was basically, like, nailed. Like, Ty West nailed it in this film.
Yeah.
So he had pretty high praise for the film. And I, you know, I'm going to be honest, I think that the pacing was awesome. I thought there have been a lot of horror films that have slow pacing because they try to build the tension.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not easy to effectively use that slow pacing to build tension.
Yes.
I think Ty West in this film really did that, though, because you have enough of just that feeling all the time, based on the environment, based on the backstory that's been laid out, and who you know is around. You know what I mean? Because you know Victor's out there. You don't really believe that the Ullmans have truly left at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're just kind of waiting, and it's the anticipation, and things keep ramping up and ramping up and ramping up. And then they had a great, you know, jump scare moment where she had called for the pizza, and then it's getting real intense, and she's very fearful, and you can feel it. And then all of a sudden, the telephone rings, and it's just like this, oh my God, oh my God. And she picks it up, and it's the pizza delivery guy. It's like, oh, jeez. not really the pizza delivery guy, but...
It's Victor. You know, yeah.
Yeah, it's Victor. She believes it is. So it's this kind of moan of like, oh my God, like, you got me, you got me.
I loved how she, like, when she answers the door, she just throws a crumpled up 20 at him.
Yeah.
And she's like, here, just keep the change. And the thing is that the pizza only cost $8. So that was...
Well, that wasn't her money, though, was it?
No, it was the money that the Omens had left for her to order some pizza because...
But she should have pocketed the rest.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah, but, I mean, as Mr. Omen says, I hear you college kids like that. So, I mean, he was working to plant that subliminal message.
Yeah.
You know, order pizza. Because
they drugged it.
Yeah, and then...
But here... Okay, here was another small problem I had. She ate, like, one bite.
A half a bite. Like, yeah. Half of... Maybe half of a slice.
And that knocked her out.
Yeah.
I found that kind of stupid.
She might have been a lightweight.
Whatever. I guess. That just kind of seemed a little ridiculous to me. But it's a very small issue. Very small issue. So trivial.
Yeah.
One of the other things for me, the house itself was great.
It was a well-designed house.
I think they did an amazing job picking that location for the film. It kind of felt to me like it was its own character.
Yeah.
Because it was so... It just added so much. And it just... Her exploring the entire house and building the tension that way was just so cool. Like, it was so labyrinthine. You did not know what she was going to run into next. Whether it was just going to be something interesting that she found, or, you know, a new room, or was she going to, you know, run into a dead body, or was she going to run into someone with a knife? Like, You didn't know. And the house was so big that you could realistically spread the time out for her to, like, really explore it and build tension over that time period.
One thing I thought was funny about when she was exploring the house was she opens up the door to the basement and turns on the light. And, of course, you know the rule for horror movies. Don't go down to the basement.
Correct.
So it was actually really funny to see her just stick her head in and go, eh, basement, yeah. And then go about looking over through the rest of the house.
Which may have very well been a kind of clever nod to, this is what they always do, don't do it.
Right, exactly.
But then she does all sorts of other stupid stuff, like, you know, Mr. Allman says at one point that I promise to make this as painless for you as possible. I mean, if that couldn't be, you know, any more telegraphic, I would like to murder you. But also, with how crazed he is about throwing money at her.
Yeah.
Because at first it's $50. They settle on $400.
Yeah.
For one night of babysitting. And the fact that it was suspicious anyway, because he was like, okay, it's not actually a child. I'm sorry, I lied to you just to get you here. It's my mother. My old decrepit mother. But you don't have to actually do anything.
You just have to be
in the house. Like, all of that says... Stop. Big red stop sign. Like, no.
Well, you know, and also another thing that I was thinking about was, like, it's ridiculous how much money he's throwing away on her. Probably, you know, since they already had it planned that they were going to do the whole you're going to mother the Antichrist routine, that that they were going to keep the money anyway. So it was just anything that he could do to keep her in the house. They weren't going to lose that money anyway. They didn't lose the $20. They weren't going to lose the $400.
Yeah, just take it out of her pocket when she's dead. Is exactly how they figured that one.
Exactly.
A few other things. I've got some kind of random things I have written down I want to make sure we get to. I felt like the gore was very well orchestrated. The gore looks realistic. It looks good. The blood didn't look like real fakey or anything like that. And I will say one of the best gore moments, I talked about it before, when Megan's face gets blown off. But they made it so creepy then after that because she had lit a cigarette. Yeah. She gets her face blown off by Victor. Victor gets in the car, takes her cigarette, and just sits there and smokes it. Like, that is a perfect moment of, okay, now you just realize this guy is, like, super psycho.
Yeah.
Like, not just a psycho.
He's messed
like,
up.
Like, psycho, psycho.
Yeah.
Like, cool, calm, and collected about murdering anyone, pretty much. He's just like, yeah, this is just... This is what I do. This is just another day.
Of course, Megan parks in a cemetery in a remote part of Connecticut.
What is smart.
What does she expect to have happen?
Well, when they're going to the house, it really made me think, watching this, how afraid I would be to not have GPS or cell phones now.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Because think about that context. You get a job for babysitting. It already seems suspicious.
It's 10, 15 miles away in the dark.
You drive there. You don't have any phone that you can use. unless those people let you use the phone. But if they're going to kill you, they're not going to let you use the phone.
Right. Except to order pizza.
And if your ride doesn't come back, you don't know how to get home.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, this all screams perv alert. But,
Or satanic cult alert.
Yeah, yeah. But Sam needs the money, so she's willing to put up with it. But, I mean, you know, one of the things that, for me, you were talking about how it built tension for her to walk around the house and everything like that. To me, it kind of felt like it was deflating tension. You know, because, and this might be something that we disagree on, which is fine. But, you know, it's like, she walks around, she checks out the bathroom, she checks out the kitchen, she checks out the living room. She checks out all of these different rooms in the house. She even goes up to the second floor and looks around and finds a room with like a children's room with a Western on the wall, a mural on the wall, lots of trophies and everything like that. And she goes to the door where, like you said, there's a room full of bodies. And she, like, kind of is curious about it. But then she decides to go down and get pizza.
Yeah.
So that, like, completely...
She didn't even see the bodies.
Right, exactly. So it, like, completely, to me, deflated the tension.
Really? I feel like...
Because...
For me, it ratcheted it up because you're seeing more of the psychotic side of these people.
Well, you are. The viewer is.
Yeah, exactly.
But she's not.
Well, and that's why I feel like it is ratcheting it up because she's unaware... And you're kind of like, well, what's she going to do now? She's going to walk herself into a terrible situation. So you're afraid that she has no idea what she's doing. You know what I mean?
Well, I can kind of see that. But it, like, the way that it felt like it was deflating it was that she's not interacting with anything at all in the scene. She's like... She's
interacting
going,
with the house.
She's going around and she's looking at the house. But if she had been interacting with, like, Megan over the phone... You know, or something like that, and telling her, oh, yeah, look at this, look at that. You know, this is an interesting thing. I wonder where this came from. And then, you know, you realize it. Because I do realize that a good, strong part of storytelling is show, don't tell.
Right.
But the way that it was shown to you is, like, she's making all of these, like, jumps mentally. You know, and it's not ratcheting up the tension. She looks outside. She realizes that these people in this one photograph are not the same people that got into the same car that's in the photograph. And so that starts ratcheting up in her mind after she gets the pizza. You know, so really, when she gets the pizza, that's when the tension starts ratcheting up again. But she's just sitting there watching television for a while. And, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's something that I would do at home. And... It kind of gets a little... It got to a point where I nearly fell asleep.
We definitely are going to disagree on this, because I thought it was very well done, and it did ratchet up the tension. Especially when you just kind of... When you have in the back of your mind the idea that, you know, Victor's out there near the house, lurking around, and you know there was something suspicious that was going to happen anyway, because of the way the Almonds were acting, and you're not 100% sure that they're actually gone. And... Who is this old lady? You know what I mean? Like, are you going to run into the old lady and she's going to be, you know, some sort of menace? You don't know. But when you keep those things in your mind, it's different. But also, I think for me, there's another aspect to it, which is I like exploration in films.
Mm-hmm.
So the exploration of the house was kind of satisfying that interest of mine. So that was speaking to me also. But I don't know. I think we definitely are just going to disagree on this.
I think it's a... It's a question of, is it developing, what is the priority of the what's being shown? If it's to show the house and how some little things don't add up, well then, okay, it did that fine. But if you have an interest in characters and how the character develops and everything like that, I don't know if it really did a great job of building that up. I mean, even if there had been like a child or a cat, you know, that she's talking to while she's going through, that would have made it even more interesting than her just walking around and it's dead quiet.
Well, do not see the movie The Innkeepers. Well, maybe. Because The Innkeepers has the same kind of, like, very slow tension build. But there is actually, there are two people.
Yeah.
In the haunted, it's a haunted hotel, like right. a bed and breakfast, I right. think.
And that would be, that would, in my opinion, go over better.
Okay, then check that out and right. let me know what you think, because maybe that's the extra element you're looking for.
I'm looking, sure, explore the house, that's great. But if you explore the house, keep it shorter, or go ahead and have another individual in the house so that things ratchet up the tension when both of them realize it, because then you have an energy that's feeding off of two people rather than just one person who's kind of getting psyched out a little bit in their own mind. Because, I mean, the reason she gets psyched out is because she accidentally knocks over a vase while boogieing down to music.
Which, by the way, I think we can probably both agree that that was a fun... That was a fun
aspect. It was fun to watch her
listening to the music and dancing around.
Yeah.
And the music was very appropriate for the time period they were going for. Overall, the soundtrack was very well done.
I liked the soundtrack quite a bit, yeah.
I would actually kind of like to get the soundtrack. I liked it that much, because I love 80s music anyway.
I think it is commercially available.
Yeah, I might have to look into that one.
I might have to.
But I was just kind of letting you go, spinning your wheels on that, because I totally disagree. For me it worked, and I think part of it was, you know, you're talking about having two entities there to feed off the energy. For me, I immerse myself to a point where I feel like I am that other entity there, feeding, you know, and the energy's playing off that way. So,
I mean,
it's different for everyone.
Also, I think one other thing to remember is that it's, you know, that something is going to happen.
Right.
And part of my reaction to watching a horror movie is like, okay, come on, let's get to it. Because let's get this over with, so that then there can be the catharsis after the horrific event has occurred. So, I mean, once she starts getting all panicked and drugged out and everything like that, and then there's the blinking light, once that starts, then the tension ratchets up again for me, because I know that there's going to be the catharsis after that part.
So it looks like you're looking for the end game and the solution to everything, and I'm more of a person who takes interest in the adventure of it all.
And they're both
fundamental
viable yeah. ways to look at that type of thing.
So, I mean, I'm sure that people will listen to this podcast, and some people are like, Jordan, you're 100% right. And some people, like, Carlin, you're 100% right. And it's just the way it is. Or there are probably some people like, you both are dead wrong.
Yeah. So. It's all about watching people get hacked up. And there wasn't enough hacking. No, I'm just kidding. But anyway.
There wasn't enough. Oh, okay. So this is, we're running out of time.
We are.
I did want to say, the end where Sam lives and it's obvious that she has the spawn of Satan in her belly made me think I would really like to see a sequel to this. Could be really interesting. And the concept is that she's trying to get rid of the evil spawn in her stomach, but she's having such a hard time and she can't because she's locked up in a psych ward. Boom. That could be a great film.
That
right
could
there.
Be a pretty good movie. And that would fit well into the 80s,
yeah.
80s genre. One thing that I wanted to mention about the end of the movie was that it really showed... I wrote this down. The moral of the story is that Satanists are ineffective at what they do.
Right.
You know?
They're always going to screw up.
Because she's... You've got... Mother basically looks like she's half human, half demon anyway.
Correct.
You know, and then she's like... so ineffectual that Sam is able to escape the bonding that they have her tied down with.
Yeah, they should have been Boy Scouts or
exactly.
Girl Scouts, like, to learn how to tie knots.
You know, you tie it down with the plastic knots, and then you light it a lighter underneath it, because then it melts the fibers together and holds it in solidly.
So you could be a better Satanist.
I could be.
Maybe that's your calling.
Except I'm a Methodist. So.
Methodist, Satanist, I don't know the difference. I will say on that note, though, about Satanism, the whole satanic panic thing was a legitimate issue back in the 80s.
Right.
And I don't think the 70s so much, but the 80s, I think early 90s. A perfect example being the whole situation with the West Memphis 3. If nobody's familiar with the West Memphis 3, look it up. Basically, some young kids who were into, like, metal music and, you know, pretended like they were into Satanism were basically looked at by the community as being actual Satanists, and people were afraid of that, so they basically indicted them of they found them guilty on murder, and they were murders that they did not commit. So
yeah, it, well, and
the satanic panic thing was real.
Here's the thing: is that we always find something to be afraid of,
right?
No matter what. And right now, you know, in the '80s, it was the satanic panic and Dungeons and Dragons, and yeah. And now in 2014, everybody's afraid of Ebola.
Yeah, and thankfully, not afraid of Dungeons and Dragons anymore.
No, because we would be in trouble.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's go ahead and give our final thoughts for the House of the Devil.
Would you like to go first, and then I'll and then sure. I'll lift us up a little.
Well, no, I'm not going
I to. Think you'll be fine with it, but I want to end it on the upswing.
Sure. So I thought that this movie did a great job in terms of capturing the feel of what I was looking for, in terms of the mood and the camera choices, editing choices, everything like that was really well done. Soundtrack was great. I thought the acting was fantastic, especially for
Tom Noonan.
Tom Noonan,
yeah, he killed it.
He really knocked it out of the park with this.
He killed it, and then he almost killed it.
Yeah, he killed it, and then he said, "Kill me," and she goes to commit suicide, and then fails because apparently, being the incubator for the Antichrist is not going to work out if you're trying to commit suicide.
No.
But overall, I thought that the acting was really good. I thought the movie was really good. I thought they used the tropes of the genre very well. I just wish that the pacing had been a little tighter. 95 minutes, you can still shave out 5 minutes of walking around the house and be perfectly fine. And then move on and have a good time. Overall, I'll give it 3 stars.
Okay. I liked it a little bit more than Jordan. I thought the pacing was really good. I liked the tense buildup. In my opinion, it was tense buildup. Like Jordan said, the acting was outstanding, especially Tom Newman. Oh my God, Tom Newman. Noonan in this, so good. I loved the whole 80s feel to it. This is a perfect nostalgia film.
Better than Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Oh, God. For 80s. Way better than Beyond the Black Rainbow. Yeah. Jeez. These are like opposite ends of the spectrum, pretty much, in success.
Yeah.
There aren't a whole lot of films that are done now that are trying to be like decades past. But if anyone attempts that, and I would like to see it done more often, they should look at what Ty West did here and emulate it because it worked so well.
It's really interesting that we're not getting a lot of period pieces set in the 70s right now. We're getting plenty of period pieces in the 40s, some in the 50s and 60s, but nothing in the 70s or 80s.
Yeah. The soundtrack to me was great in this film. It hit the 80s perfectly. Everything looked 80s. The environment that it was shot in was very smartly chosen. The house was an amazing design. Yeah, everything was really good. Not the most amazing thing. Obviously, the story isn't super original, but that's kind of intentional. Like, it was supposed to be that way because it's supposed to remind you of these films from the 80s.
It's a trope homage.
Yeah, exactly. All that said, I did enjoy it, and I would recommend it. 3.5 stars for me. So, for the podcast overall, 3.25 stars, which is a pretty good rating.
That's a solid rating for us.
Yeah. And I was actually talking before we started recording, but I said to Jordan, you know, there are horror films that I get very jazzed about and say, I think these are really great horror films, but I don't give them, like, crazy high marks on the show because when I'm saying they're great horror films, it's comparing them to other horror films. And there are a lot of bad horror films out there. So within the genre, I get really excited about it, but when you compare it to all films, it's not going to stack up as
and
well.
And I think that's kind of how we rated Hellraiser.
Yes, definitely. Because when it comes to horror films, Hellraiser is probably in my top, like, 25. It's one of my faves. But I gave it 3 stars because it's not, like, the most phenomenal film. There were a lot of shortcomings. But for that genre, I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
So.
Well, anyway, I think we're pretty much out of time for this episode of Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night. Thanks so much for listening. And, Carlin, is your mother upstairs or is that someone else?
I don't know, Jordan. Why don't you eat this pizza?
Thanks.
You've been listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night.
Our theme music was provided by Sweet Wave Audio. To find more royalty-free music for your own projects, check out sweetwaveaudio.co.uk.
And special thanks to Ariana Ramos for her graphic design savvy helping us with our album art.
Visit our website at mostexcellentmovienight.com to listen to other episodes, give us your opinion, and share with us other movies you'd like to have reviewed.
You can also contact us through our email address, mostexcellentmovienight@gmail.com. We would love to read them on the air.
Also, if you could rate and review the podcast on iTunes, we would be your friends for life.
For sure. That's all for now. Thanks for listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night,
where movies are most excellent.
This has been a Nerd Circle podcast production.